Nandaki Jai, Kaur Premanande, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the lotus feet of Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, 29th chapter, talks between Narada and King Prachinabarhi. It's text number 60 this morning. Narada,
Narada,
Uvacha,
Uvacha,
Yena,
Yena,
Eva,
Eva,
Arabate,
Arabate,
Karma,
Karma,
Tena,
Tena,
Eva,
Eva,
Amutra,
Amutra,
Tat,
Tat,
Puman,
Puman,
Bhunte,
Bhunte,
Hi,
Hi,
Avyavadhanena,
Avyavadhanena,
Lingena,
Lingena,
Manasa,
Manasa,
Swayam,
Swayam,
Narada Uvacha,
Narada Uvacha,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Bhuktehya Vavyavadhena,
Bhuktehya Vavyavadhena.
I said that wrong, didn't I? Bhuktehya Vayavadhanena,
Bhuktehya Vayavadhanena,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Narada Uvacha,
Narada Uvacha,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Tenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Tenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Punteya Vyavadanena,
Punteya Vyavadanena,
Ingena Manasa Swayam,
Ingena Manasa Swayam,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Teya Vyavadanena,
Teya Vyavadanena,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenavate Karma,
Tenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Yenaiva, Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Rabbate Karma,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Yenaiva Mutra Tatpuman,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Bhuktehya Vyavadhanena,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
Lingena Manasa Swayam,
place.
Narada uvacha.
Narada said.
Yena.
By which.
Eva.
Certainly.
Arabhate.
Begins.
Karma.
Fruitive activities.
Tena.
By that body.
Eva.
Certainly.
Amutra.
In the next life.
Tat.
That. Human.
The living entity.
Bhukte. Enjoys.
He.
Because. Avyavadhanena. Without any change. Lingena.
By the subtle body. Manasa.
By the mind. Swayam.
Personally.
Translation. The great sage Narada continued. The living entity acts in a gross body in this life. This body is forced to act by the subtle body, composed of mind, intelligence, and ego. After the gross body is lost, the subtle body is still there to enjoy or suffer. Thus, there is no change. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The living entity has two kinds of body, the subtle body and the gross body. Actually, he enjoys through the subtle body, which is composed of mind, intelligence, and ego. The gross body is the instrumental outer covering. When the gross body is lost, or when it dies, the root of the gross body, the mind, intelligence, and ego, continues and brings about another gross body. Although the gross body appears changed, although the gross bodies apparently change, the real root of the gross body, the subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego, is always there. The subtle body's activities, be they pious or impious, create another situation for the living entity to enjoy or suffer in the next gross body. Thus, the subtle body continues, whereas the gross bodies change one after another. Since modern scientists and philosophers are too materialistic, and since their knowledge is taken away by the illusory energy, they cannot explain how the gross body is changing. The materialistic philosopher, Darwin, has tried to study the changes of the gross body, but because he has no knowledge of either the subtle body or the soul, he could not clearly explain how the evolutionary process is going on. One may change the gross body, but he works in the subtle body. People cannot understand the activities of the subtle body, and consequently they are bewildered as to how the actions of one gross body affect another gross body. The activities of the subtle body are also guided by the supersoul, as explained in Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sannivishta Mata Smitya Jnanam Apohanam Cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Because the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Supersoul is always guiding the individual soul, and the individual soul always knows how to act. Because the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Supersoul is always guiding the individual soul always knows how to act according to the reactions of his past karma. In other words, the Supersoul reminds him to act in such a way. Therefore, although there is apparently a change in the gross body, there is a continuation between the lives of an individual soul. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Simati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivishesha Sunyavaripas Chachade Sitarane Om Gyanam Timaran Dasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chaksuri Militam Jainam Tasmai Si Gurave Namaha Vanshakalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyeva Cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So Narada here is answering a question. In the previous verse, how is it possible to enjoy or suffer the reactions of work in a different body? One is in one body doing different things, soul dies, goes to another body. What's the connection that whatever you did in this past affects you in the future? So Narada now lays out the science of how this happens, and also Prabhupada gives a little more details in the purport. So it's important to know this, because as Prabhupada points out, the material science is for two reasons, not able to investigate this properly. So he says, so we see in this life, the living entity acts in a gross body. Yena eva arabhate karma. That karma is begun in this gross body. And he says, and then that same is continues in the next body. Because the linga, which is a linga, means a covering, a sheath that goes around something, that does subtle body is sometimes called linga. That remains the same. So Prabhupada says that I am embodied. We should understand there are two bodies, or you could say, two layers. So one is called, here we have the words gross and subtle. Gross means more apparent to our senses. You can hear it, see it, taste it, touch it, smell it. That's gross. In Sanskrit, stula is gross body, stula, sharira. Sharira is body, and stula means just like gross. Then the other is called subtle, shukshma, sharira. Fine, hard, so that's hard to perceive by the senses. So that's the meaning of this gross and subtle. So the subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, and ego. Here in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has told Arjuna, I'm going to tell you about everything there is in the world. Everything that there is, I'm going to give you all knowledge, and if you know this, then you'll understand everything. There's nothing more to be known, he says. You'd be surprised he does it, huh? This is everything. So first he gives a list, huh? Bhumir, Apaha, Anala, Vayu, Kham, Mano, Budhir, Evacha, Ahankara. This is the list. Iti, this list. He is here. All these. Dina Prakriti Ashtaga, my eight separated, cut off Prakriti energy. So here's earth, water. Bhumi is earth. Apaha, water. Anala, fire. Vayu, air. Kham means ether. So right away you see in this list, you go from gross to more subtle. Earth is more apparent to the senses. Earth you can see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. Apa is a little less evident, more so. Fire, even subtler. Vayu, air, subtler ever. And then what they call calm, ether, we just see empty space. We just see empty space. That's the most the subtlest, right? So this is basically what the material scientist can study. By the way, if this list sounds really old-fashioned and medieval, Bhaktisiddhanta put them in English this way, more scientifically sounding. For earth, he says solids, things that are solid. Huh? Then liquids for water. Solids, liquids, the fire, radiant energy. Air, gases, and then for either, space. Now space is subtle, but it's not nothing. Even, at least according to modern physics, if you use quantum mechanics, mathematics of quantum mechanics to describe empty space, it takes up quite a few pages. So space is not nothing. Also, they say space curves. And there are different geometries according to this curvature of the space. But this list keeps going. Even subtler than space, manas. And more subtle, buddhi. And then ahankara, the subtlest. So here Krishna is beginning his list of what there is, and now he's only talking about his bina prakriti, his separated energies, which he lists as eight. Material science can only deal with five. Manas, buddhi, ahankara, is mind, intelligence, and ego, as Prabhupada translates them. These are the three elements of that make up the subtle body of a living entity. So we have this the gross body and the subtle body, but you notice they're both material. And they're all material, and they're also part of the same interactive causal network. They affect each other. Now this is also important to know because, of course, Greek thought and coming into Christian thought, the idea of the soul is there. But you see in the history of all this Western thinking, almost always the notion of the mind, or you could say what we call the subtle body, and the soul are confused. They're considered almost the same thing. They don't know distinction. Well, this is very very interesting fact for the history of the West, because and then when the idea maybe that I die but my soul lives, in one sense the gross body goes away but the subtle body continues. If that's what you mean, but you get another ghost body. But when they try to talk about, but then they think the soul is immortal. They don't say eternal. I mean, immortal means it has a beginning but no end. Whereas really, eternal means no beginning and no end. But they say immortal soul. Again, this subtle body lasts longer. It does continue. But there's nothing immortal about it. And in fact, you don't want it. It's ultimately the cause of bondage, the subtle body. It's easy to get rid of the gross body, but if you can't get rid of the subtle body, you take birth again. We're liberated from the gross body over and over again, but again we acquire another one. So there's a lot of confusion in this, but here there's so much clarity that in the next verse, apareya mitastva anya prakritin divine param. So you should know that besides this apara, this inferior prakriti, there is another ayam prakritin, which is param, superior. What is it? Jiva Buddha, the existence of the jivas. That's a whole nother energy. So these two things, Krishna says, these are his two energies, his properties. One is this material energy of this eight, and the other is the jivas. And then they flow together, like two rivers merging. And then there's the world. All created beings have their source in these two natures. And where do they come from? They come from me. I am their Prabhava and Pralaya. They come out and they go back into me. So now you have the third thing. Matter, spirit, and the source of both of them. And then, madap prataram nanyat kinchid asti. And beyond me, there's nothing more to be known. That's it. So actually, he's really explained. This is all that there is. Matter, spirit, and the source of both. And many times when Prabhupada describes what knowledge is, he says these is to know what is matter, what is spirit, and what is the origin of both. So that constitutes the whole field of knowledge. So material science, they've gone part of the way into matter. Of the manas, buddhi, ahankara, they don't really know and can't deal with. And as far as the jiva, that's way out there. And then as far as the origin of both, that's even further out from them. So their understanding is partial. One reason Prabhupada says they don't know this, because they are too materialistic. That is to say, what they think of science is what you can perceive by the senses. And even a little more restrictive, really, modern material science wants to deal with the world to the extent that you can express it in terms of numbers. Now, our experience deals with qualities and quantities. But actually science, to be what they want to call strictly science, sometimes they call it hard science, because there are other things that are soft sciences. Soft means they're not so good at expressing it in terms of numbers, and most people say, yeah, that's not really science. And the people in the soft sciences, I mean like sociology and psychology, they want to be called a science. But where are your numbers, huh? It's hard to do. So they're always trying to become more scientific by figuring out how to express their findings in numbers. Because that's been the most successful so far as they're concerned, as far as controlling or manipulating material nature. You do it with numbers best. So our experience is certainly not limited to numbers, but science kind of abstracts from our experience and only considers the numbers. And they're very happy. It looks like something that's not a number, like we see the color red. And it turns out, you know, that they can express it as a certain wavelength of light, a number. We can deal with it. So some things that don't look like they're associated with numbers, they have managed to find numbers for them. And so they think if we can keep on going, it'll be all numbers and nothing but numbers. So this is really what's going on. This is what Prabhupada means by materialistic. And when you can express things in terms of numbers, it's certainly useful. And you take anything that happens, and you can always ask, how wide is it? How long is it? How high is it? How heavy is it or light? How fast or how slow? You know, all these different, how rough, how smooth, you find all ways to put these in terms of numbers. Right? And it's very useful. It's like a tool for doing things, putting things in terms of numbers. So they achieve some success with this. And then they become, then they say, and they say, so they don't just say, we have a useful tool that only deals with the world in terms of numbers. There's some things we can't deal with. No, then they say, if it cannot be expressed in terms of numbers, it doesn't exist. It's not really there. That's a little different. Huh? That's really a claim of based on faith. But that's what they do. That's why when it comes to manas, buddhi, ahankara, they have a hard time. Because subtle means very hard to express in terms of numbers. And they wall it off. Because they want to say, you know, there's this ambition to become omniscient. To want to know everything. Some scientists in physics would like to say that we want to get the ultimate equation that explains everything in the world is small enough so you can print it on a t-shirt. The idea to be comprehensive. So basically, if we cannot deal with it in terms of numbers, as far as we're concerned, it doesn't really exist. It's not there. So there are philosophers, scientists, and also some philosophers who at different times have really argued that there's no such thing as mind.
Yeah.
They call this the idea of the mind, of the idea of the ghost and the machine. That and so they want to say, for these philosophers, in support of the project of material science, that there's no hidden, no occult process going on inside, which we call a mind. Really, what there is, like when I say you are angry, I don't, you know, I'm starting to think of something inside that we can't detect called anger, or can be expressed in terms of number. But really what I mean when I say that you are angry is that your face is getting red, and that your loud sounds are coming out of your mouth, and your fist is shaking. So really, to say somebody is angry, means to really say that they're behaving in an angry way. And so really, all that's all, we can get rid of this hidden thing. So they try to make this, I'm serious. You can still get the book. There's an English philosopher, Gilbert Ryle, The Concept of Mind, why he lays out this whole program for what a philosophical behaviorism to get rid of the ghost and the machine. So this is people, and the ones who really take this the most seriously in science are people in computer cognitive science and computer technology, because a computer is a machine made of material nature, and a computer, both hardware and software, can be completely expressed in terms of numbers, strings of ones and zeros, at the binary number system. You can say everything is going on, nothing is left over in a computer, simply by strings of ones and zeros. So now our project is to make a computer with so nicely made and nicely programmed that if you're dealing with the computer, you could not tell the difference of whether that was a computer or a live human being. This is called the Turing test. This is their goal, to make this computer, because partially not only because they have good computers, but they'll show that, see, you and I are nothing but a string of ones and zeros. There's this thing that we call consciousness and everything, but that's really just fuzzy stuff. But what's really there is just ones and zeros. If I can't tell the difference, if I'm dealing with somebody on the phone, you know, already they're confused. You're ordering something, or you call the government and could you tell me your name? Tell me your name. And then they say, is that spelled this? You know, the computer has these programs to respond. They're not that good yet, but maybe they'll become really, really good. You know, voice recognition software. Anyway, that's their program, to say like this. Because they really, these things, manas, buddhi, ahankara, cause a problem. And what really causes a problem is consciousness. Because they want to tell a story, right? The world is simply matter. That also, in that, their terms and means, numbers, express it in terms of numbers. It is just made up structures of matter, fully definable by numbers, fully describable by numbers. And then they want to tell the story that somehow or other, in the very beginning, there were just these very, very simple structures, material structures. And in the course of time, they become more complex, more complicated, adding things to them. So they're more complex, but you still, you can all express them in terms of numbers. So you have structures of matter, and then you have more and more complicated structures of matter. Then life appears. After they get sufficiently complex, then there's life evolves. But what they're saying is something else at a certain point comes into existence that is not just a structure of matter, but the experience of the structures of matter. So that's what we're talking about, consciousness. And I think in the most fundamental sense, consciousness means to be able to experience. Not just to be a structure of matter, but to have the experience of structure of matter. That you're a subject and not just an object. So then suddenly there's the experience of structures of matter. Now, that doesn't fit into this picture, really. Really, all you just get is more and more complex structures of matter. But we have this thing we undergo all the time called experiences. What is that? What makes science possible to begin with? But somehow or other, it doesn't fit into the total world picture, the materialistic, mechanistic picture. So this is a problem for them. It's another kind of a thing. And they want to say it comes from structures of matter. But Bhagavad Gita says, no, it doesn't at all. It's another kind of a thing, and it comes from... both of them come from Krishna. That's the difference in the picture. So they're really trying to take this, what they know, apir analo vayu kam, just that, and from just that, try to understand the whole. So naturally, this idea of changing bodies, how it happens, what subtle body, they can't understand it. It's because their tools can't deal with it, and then they want to say that if our tools can't deal with it, it doesn't exist. This is an element of pride that causes this dogmatism, and Prabhupada calls this their knowledge is taken away by the illusory energy. They are too materialistic, and their knowledge is taken away by the illusory energy. They think we know everything, or we're going to know everything in the near future. Meanwhile, in our body, this whatever is happening, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, in a living body, things are happening that you will not be able to explain just by measuring those five things. I think this is where one really needs to examine things that happen without a cause. Because when you see things happening without a cause, the first thing you look for are hidden causes. Yeah, they're hidden causes, manas, buddhi, ahankara. Because these are all part of the same interactive system. Somehow or other, if they ever try to figure out what's going on in the living body, this is hard to do also, because it's hard to examine the details of a living body without killing it. I mean, to dissect, you have to murder. But somehow or other, if they can forget it's subtle enough and try to figure out what's going on, they'll find things happening. They can't figure out. There's some hidden causes. It'll look to them like things are happening for no reason. But really, because it is part of the interactive system, is manas, buddhi, ahankara, and everything else in living bodies, they're working together. Because manas, buddhi, ahankara is always associated with the jiva. And so if the jiva is absent, then you just get things that, you know, like this book. Those, as far as we know, manas, buddhi, ahankara are not in that book. Unless it's a very special book. this is just the other elements. So, Yeah, we have other scientific ways of exploring things. When the consciousness becomes clearer, if it's not all full of garbage from sense gratification, then you can understand these things. So then we have to know this. The subtle body. It keeps going. This manas, buddhi, ahankara. By the way, there's another thing we don't have time for, but to understand very clearly what's the difference between manas and buddhi is very important, and what ahankara is. But this is the subtle body, and he's saying that that you don't give that up. It sticks with the jiva. And so it is this that carries the karma. The karma is carried within the subtle body. Because so many desires are there. it's full of hankerings and longings and pain, memory, all these kinds of things. This keeps going. So it stays with the soul. And his activities, pious or impious, they go also with the soul, with the subtle body and the soul to the next gross body. They can't understand what is happening. People cannot understand the activities of the subtle body, and consequently they are bewildered as to how the actions of one gross body, last life, affect this one. But that hasn't changed. I still have the same subtle body has been with me for a very, very long time. Of course, sometimes the subtle body, different desires become prominent, and I may get a gross body that fits the mentality that I've acquired. So the same subtle body, you can put a dog suit on it, or a human suit, or a tree suit. All according to the characteristics of desires and karma of that subtle body. Then Prabhupada says the activities of the subtle body are also guided by the super soul. Sarvasya chaham hidisanivisto matas mitir jnanam apohanancha. I am situated in the heart of every living being, and from me comes remembrance and knowledge. Mitra here means what I remember. What I know and what I don't know. So that's governed actually by the super soul. Actually, the connection between an individual soul and the gross and subtle body is managed by the super soul. Because the soul itself has really no contact with material nature. And so for a soul to be connected with a certain subtle body and a succession of gross bodies, that connection is done by the super soul. And in fact, we of course are sitting in this body and we don't really know how it works. I want to raise my arm and my arm goes up, and if you ask me how I did that, I can't tell you. Just here's a body in material nature, this book stand. I want to raise the book stand, nothing happens. Here's another piece of material nature, my right arm, I want to raise it goes up. somehow or other I've got this connection with this piece of material nature that I don't have with that one. That my desires are fulfilled. So our body is that a part of material nature to which we are somehow or other connected in this way, in an immediate way. If I want to raise this, I have to take this and then it'll go up. But here, how do I raise my arm? How do I grab my arm to raise it? It just goes up. So we're connected in a different way with this body. And it does all kinds of wonderful things, which I just, sure, of course. I put food in my stomach and I digest and I get nourishment. You say, that's great, how did you do that? I don't know. So actually, all this stuff is provided for us by the super soul, who goes with us from body after body, as long as the subtle body. And when he says here, smitir jnanam and apohanam, jnanam means how we look at the world and what we see, how we see it, our whole mentality, our whole outlook on life. That comes from the very beginning. You see, we don't know anything unless we're interested in it. Two different people can go in the same room, and then you ask them to describe the room, and one will describe one thing. Say one's an artist, he'll describe the paintings. And the other is a person who repairs floors. He'll describe the floor. And neither will notice what the other's interested in. So what you know depends on what you're interested in. What's important or what's not important? What's interesting, what's not interesting? These things you have from the very beginning. Maybe you're born with it, and also you kind of take it in with your mother's milk. So this initial kind of predisposition of the mind to look at this or look at that or see things in this way or that thing, that's really buddhi. Most buddhi kind of intelligence, most of the time it's working, but we don't even know how it's working. But the way super soul influences us is by buddhi. It directs our attention, and therefore our thinking, feeling, and willing is done under the umbrella of this buddhi. Most philosophers and thinkers don't understand buddhi. Everything's on the mental platform. They just deal with the mind. Buddhi is more subtle and harder for people to understand. Actually, to cultivate buddhi, that's Bhagavad Gita. That's buddhi yoga. Because this buddhi is actually the way that the super soul is in our lives. And if buddhi becomes really developed, then we can understand Krishna, the super soul. Because the super soul, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam that the super soul is the form, the intelligence is the form direction of the super soul. Use this term, form direction, form with a little hyphen, a little dash, form direction. Meaning that intelligence is the form in which the super soul is directing us through this buddhi. you can see this usage. Where's my Bhagavad Gita? You can see this usage in the second chapter of intelligence. I'll find it for you. Not 60, 230 something. Yeah, 269, right. What is night for all beings is the time of awakening for the self-controlled, and the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. So here there's two kinds of people, right? The introspective sage, the transcendentalist, the devotee, and the materialist, right? And so when the materialist is awake, that is, when he sees, what he notices, so that time when it's like light to him, to everybody else is dark. And conversely, when everybody else is alert and active and interested to the devotee, nothing's happening here. So you're in the same place, but you live in two different worlds, difference of night and day. That's what this is saying. So when Prabhupada comments on this, he says, there are two classes of intelligent men. One is intelligent in material activities for sense gratification, and the other is introspective and awake to the cultivation of self-realization. You see, when he's saying intelligent, he means the buddhi. One is going this way, toward sense gratification, so that you think, feel, and will only in terms of sense gratification. If sense gratification is not an issue, you're not interested. It just goes right by you. But one who's become developed in spiritual life, they think, feel, and will in terms of spiritual advancement. If any sense gratification comes, they don't pay it any mind. See, so that's the difference. This is intelligence, how it works. Both of them, that's the kind of highest level. But there are other things too. So and intelligence really guides us as though an authority. And so what our intelligence is also predisposed from previous karma. As you take birth as a human being, you'll also take birth in a social setting. From that social setting, you'll take in a certain intelligence of your culture, a whole different way of looking at the world. That's all governed by the super soul. And so he causes the living entity to know how to act in terms of his previous karma. So this is how this takes place. So Narada Muni is now going to explain all of this to the king, Prachini Barhisha. And here is something that sooner or later, I think material science will start to suspect that there's more going on than meets their eyes. And I don't know if you'll ever be able to. They can measure subtler and subtler things, that's a fact. But I don't know if they'll ever get down to numbers for manas, buddhi, ahankara. It's not a fact that something is scientific only if it can be expressed in terms of numbers. They've almost forgotten that they abstract from our experience, and that there's ways of looking at our experience. You have to know how to do this. Another thing that Krishna says that's a real important point for those people who want knowledge is that in the Bhagavad Gita that knowledge depends on goodness, sattva. When sattva guna becomes prominent, then you start to be able to see things with great clarity. That when people, the mode of passion, there isn't really any knowledge. There's desires, and what you call knowledge is called shilpa jnana, knowledge of technical knowledge, how to make things, how to build things, weave baskets, make bricks. And really, technology is just more elaborate shilpa jnana. It's not real knowledge. Other than that, they don't know anything. In the mode of passion, they can't recognize it. They can't see it. If your aim is not technology, or if your aim starts to be self-realization, people will start to find this useful, this knowledge. Right now, they don't even see that it's useful for anything. You won't get scholarships to come to the Hare Krishna temple because it's not socially useful. That's what they think. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
Krishna, if the subtle body is very much influencing us, actually we are living according to our past karma, according to our past desires, and then also the super soul is guiding us to go to this desire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how much really we are the soul, or us ourselves are to do with what they're doing, becoming a devotee. Like I even heard that if you will go to an astrologer, then he will tell you that you become a devotee in this life, and it's already written everything. So how much are we really influencing our spiritual powers anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. In many cases, devotional service, Prabhupada says, is continued from previous lives. So sometimes astrologers can see that. You can see it in your previous life, from your child, that you've in the past done some devotional service. Just the indication is there. On the other hand, where does it begin? So there's two other factors that are beyond astrology and beyond karma. One is simply your freedom. Prabhupada said we have a little bit of freedom. And that little bit of freedom means that in spite of my karma, sometimes I can do something else. My karma doesn't absolutely determine everything. But maybe it determines probabilities. You know, there's a 85% chance you'll fall down because that's your past. But there's an area of freedom. If I do continuous sinful activities, then the chances are I will again, even though I'm free not to. If I have a habit of pious activities, there's the chance I'll do something pious, even though I'm free to fall down. See, so that the karma is like that. It's more like chances like that. But there's always this area of freedom that we have, and freedom means that sometimes we can do it. But you have to understand about free will. Free will means that when there's a jiva who's exercising free will, things happen that you cannot find a cause. If you look at the whole past, all the karma, the past history, the psychology, still something happens, and it is not determined by the material nature. It's more like, it looks just like total chance. There's absolute chance. It just happened for no reason. But the reason is, there's some free will. That means I can start something that's not part of the whole process of material nature. That's freedom. So that's always there. The second thing is the mercy of the Lord and his devotees. causeless mercy means I didn't do anything to get it. And although so many dispositions are there, but if somehow or other I come into contact, how do I come into contact with a pure devotee? Well, some of it, maybe there's something in the past, but sometimes it's just the mercy of the devotee. I didn't do anything. And sometimes that can be there in the very beginning. It can be almost, I get some prasadam. I hear the Hare Krishna mantra. All accidentally. But still that has an effect. And that can start things going. So those are two things that are sort of outside the material system of karma. The freedom of a jiva and causes mercy of the Lord. That's what can happen. And so Prabhupada has said, actually, with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the causes mercy factor is pretty heavy. So we will find that we can do things that otherwise, karmically speaking, it wouldn't happen. The astrologer, I know astrologers can do this. You must know Prahlad Nanda Swami, or know about him anyway. He was when he was a student, he was at this University of New York at Buffalo. And that was one of the first places that Rupanuga went and preached there, and he made so many devotees there. A lot of them became leaders and sannyasis in our movement. So Prahlad Ananda Swami, he was a student there, but he wasn't attending any of his classes. He learned about yoga, and he was mostly sitting in a closet doing yoga. And suddenly, then the Hare Krishna movement came. He became a devotee. Well, any day, one time, we were in Vrindavan, and some devotees I knew were seeing this astrologer, Panditji. I don't know his name. It was Panditji. So we just Prahlad Nanda Swami and I decided we'd go into Delhi and see him. And we met this person who was going to take us to see him, and it was quite an adventure getting there because all the electricity had failed in that part of Delhi, so it was quite dark and spooky. And anyway, finally we go to this rooftop where this astrologer has his little room, and it's all lit by candles because there's no electricity. And so he's looking at Prahlad Nanda Swami's chart. And he's studying. Prabhupada just gave him this chart, and it all worked out. He looks. Finally, I'll never forget this. He leans back, he puts his pencil down, and looks at Prahlad Nanda Swami, he says, "This is your last birth." I was really impressed. Completely cut. This is your last birth. But then he started talking about your planets. Prahlad Nanda Maharaj knows astrology very well. So they were talking on a very technical level that I couldn't follow. But then the astrologer said to him, he said, "Yeah, this is your last verse. However, coming sometime in the future, there's something involving Venus, a Venus period. And it could be that you may go to the heavenly planets." So see, there was this area of freedom. There was something would happen. He would be tempted or something like that. Usually Venus involves, Venus. So it's possible. So it could be you'll be liberated, but there's still some possibility. The astrologer can't tell. Can't tell what he's going to do. You see, that's the area of freedom that's even there in astrology. Okay. Now I know a lot about Prahlad Nanda Swami. Yeah?
I have a question. It said that thinking, willing, and feeling is a function of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So what about the soul? The soul also can think, or is it just...
No, the soul is just manifest to us as consciousness now. Because right now, of course, the soul is really a spiritual person. And person means you think, you feel, you will. You also hear, see, taste, touch, and smell. You have all senses. But the instrumental powers of the soul are now all expressed in terms of matter. Ramanujacharya, to describe an embodied soul, he says the soul is compacted, you know, like you take a snowball and you it's small. So the powers of the soul itself, the spiritual powers, are not manifest. They are manifest materially. So it's not that the soul is mindless or anything, but the process of devotional service, what happens is that the soul recovers its spiritual powers, and the spiritual body kind of unfolds. You know this Japanese thing where you take a little piece of folded paper and you put it in water and it opens up to a swan, something like that. Happens when there's devotional service. So what we have to do is stop our mind from thinking, feeling, and willing in terms of sense gratification, but think about Krishna, feel about Krishna, will for Krishna, and then the mind becomes spiritual. And at the same time, when that's happening with this materially manifested mind, the powers of the soul become expressed. By the way, the subtle body also has within it, within the mind rather, is also included the powers of the senses. Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and feeling. Because, and somehow or other, they act there in the subtle body to some extent. Because a person who, for some misfortune, takes the position of a ghost. A ghost is simply a subtle body without a gross body. It doesn't immediately take a gross body again. It's in this intermediate stage. So there's some perception there, and the powers of the senses are there, of not just the knowledge acquiring senses, but the karmindriya too, the, you know, moving, manipulating, making noise. All those powers are there, but they cannot really work very well. But someone who's in the position of a ghost in that subtle body, you still have all desires, but you cannot, they don't work very well. Like you can't fulfill them. And that's why you want to go and take over somebody else's gross body. So ghosts are a kind of subtle parasite on the subtle body. And Ayurvedic medicine, I mean, the part of Ayurvedic medicine that deals with mental disease is called Bhuta Vidya, the science of ghosts. So that if somebody's mind is somehow or other is very much in the mode of ignorance and rightly disposed, then the Bhutas will come and somehow latch on to it. That's how that takes place. So that's what a ghost is. So the subtle body also has this, in a certain way, at least the powers of the senses. So there's the power of tasting and somehow or other. But then you have a gross body, you know. Then you get the right kind of tongue. Maybe it's a human tongue. Maybe it's one of these tongues of a frog, you know, it goes way out. Can taste different things. or the powers of seeing. We have these two eyes, you know. But, the, you know, a fly has an eye that, you know, goes all the way around. There's compound eye with millions of things, and other things have eyes on little stalks that, and so the eyes are, the power of seeing is different. And also you see different kinds of colors and stuff like that. But the power of theirs is that sense of seeing is there in the subtle body also. Anything else? Yeah?
Just a question. What's now the impact what the devotees have on the material science? For example, the Bhaktivedanta Institute. Because it is the reality described, mm-hmm. and actually the scientists are usually also interested in the reality, not only, mm-hmm. you know, this thing. So what impact they have, and...
I think, you know, especially in this area dealing with consciousness, there's some contact with a lot of sciences. And in other areas too, I think we're having an impact, but I don't think you'll see the effect. Typically, the impact that we have is on young scientists. Only you'll see the difference, you know, in 20 years. Things change in science. I mean, people have studied the history of science and how new ideas change. And very rarely, like when there's some big revolution in science, you know, when Newtonian physics is out and Einstein mechanics is in, or, you know, all these different scientific huge changes, very few people change their mind. And really what happens is younger people learn the new thing and the older people die. this is what tends to happen. Very few people actually change their mind, unless, you know, those who are young, but those who are already set in their ways and have written 100 papers in this particular line of work, they can't change. They don't, rarely it happens. That's just the way the human thing works. So whatever effect we are having, you won't see it at first. And also, I think in some areas, there are some science, like who are this in America, there's this intelligent design, so-called, which is different from the Christian fundamentalists, really, although they tried to take it over, create a lot of problems. But intelligent design really means to say that if you just take all the numbers, it doesn't work. It's like mathematical biology. And so there are some professors now who really believe this, that just on the basis of science, you cannot explain the development of living organisms and so on. It's just as mathematical biology. This is controversial. It's not very well accepted. It means you can't explain everything in terms of numbers. You have to bring in something from the outside. Intelligent life. Now, doesn't mean that the Bible is right. Doesn't it mean that there's a God? Just it means somewhere there's information out there. Where it comes from, we don't say. But just some deposit of organizations. It's just by chance. The scientists know this, you know. I mean, they really... there was a meeting of cosmologists some years ago in Washington, D.C., people who study the origin and development of the universe. And somebody proved... he gave an argument at this conference. I read an account of it in a science periodical. That if you give a certain amount of time that the Earth is supposed to be 4.5 billion years or whatever, and you say that at the very beginning conditions are completely random, there's no order whatsoever, And then by the mathematics that studies these things, there's just simply not nearly enough time for any amount of order to emerge, what's bigger, the order that we see here, the organization. And these organization and disorganization can be expressed in statistical mathematics. There's just not enough time. In many, many more billions of years, it's just by chance for this to emerge. But you can do this, you can do this in mathematics. So this person at the conference proposed that at the very beginning there was some order. Then if you have a little order at the very beginning, then it could happen by everything. So, but at the conference then, people were unsatisfied with that solution, because if there's some order at the beginning, you want to ask, how did it get there? In other words, the usual thing is that there's no order. In other words, like a deck of cards that's completely shuffled, you know, there's no order. But they're saying at the very beginning the deck is, you know how cheaters at cards, they stack the deck. So there's a stack deck. So this article described that some scientists in this debate actually mentioned God, who stacked the deck. But then it said, but most science rejected it because that's a cop-out. In other words, that cop-out means an easy answer. But because really is sort of the rules of science is you can't bring in God. I mean, that as soon as you do that, oh, you don't, that's not science. God, by that's just the rule. It's not even a conclusion. It's just the rule. No God, right? So, but there it is. I mean, so these kind of things happen all the time. So, but they just, well, we'll figure it out later. And then when you really go into mathematical biology, it gets really hard. So this has come up. Now, unfortunately, some of these Christian creationists have taken a hold of this and then want to get their version of the creation story taught in the school as creation science. And everybody flipped out because, except, so it was a big controversy. And unfortunately, now this intelligent design, but actually the way it is, it's just some scientists who have seen this. Now, this was explained to me by Sadaputta in 1971. You know, I had some correspondence with Prabhupada. He wanted me to, I was in the religion department PhD program, and he wanted me to stay. And Prabhupada suggested that, I asked him, and he had any suggestions what I could write a PhD thesis on. And he said, one thing he suggested was that I defeat Darwin. And I was in a state of shock because I had no, first of all, I realized, yeah, Krishna consciousness means Darwin is wrong, but I never really thought defeat him. And all the people I grew up with, I spent some of my life in what's called the Bible Belt in America, and I knew all these people who were against Darwin, but I didn't want to be like them. So I had no idea how to go about this. How was it possible to defeat Darwin? Anyway, it wouldn't work in a religion department. But I just didn't. I couldn't see. And the fact is that Prabhupada wanted to do it was amazing to me. And then I met Sadaputta. At that time, he just finished getting a PhD in mathematics. Nobody knew what to do with him. He was at New Vrindavan for some reason, and they made him a treasurer because he had a PhD in mathematics. But of course, a treasurer needs other skills, like people skills. So he didn't do so well as a treasurer, and so I don't know, he was on traveling sankirtan or something. But anyway, he's at my temple, and I showed him this letter I had from Prabhupada about defeating Darwin. And Sadaputta said to me, oh yeah, Darwin's wrong. He says, I knew that before I became a devotee. And he says, actually, most mathematicians know this, he said. But they don't say anything because it upsets the biologists so much. So if he's right, I mean, here's this thing sitting there in science that at least mathematicians, those who are mathematically inclined, understand there's this problem. And it just, they're just holding off. You know, because the mathematicians, they don't care. Darwin is right, Darwin is wrong, this theory, that theory, this form of chemistry, that mathematics is eternal. it's true in all possible worlds. So they don't care. But these other people who have built their careers and lives and whole, you know, they can't deal with it. So, but because Sariputta was talking about these things in the 70s, and I was already published in some books, you know, mechanistic and non-mechanistic science in the early 80s, I think people, these guys are using his same arguments. But they just don't want to say, well, I learned this from a Hare Krishna or something. I think it's having some influence, but it will take time. In any case, but it will happen. So you've got to really stop. Srila Prabhupada, yeah.